from San Francisco. Welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
Nearly all the heart research is done on the bodies of men. So if you go out as a woman and you have a heart problem, you can roughly guess that the cardiologist with whom you are talking is working from a literature based on the physical bodies of men. And then they make various imaginative guesses about what that is for the bodies of women.
Dr. Hilary Rose is director of the West Yorkshire Centre for Research on Women at the University of Bradford. Acknowledging that the great bulk of scientific knowledge and methodology has been developed by males, she examines the gender assumptions in science.
I think artists of any era use whatever washes up on their mud bank. And these days, sensors and processors and monitors are washing up in our mud banks.
Beverly Reiser can only be described as a high-tech artist. Working with light and images, all controlled by the computer, this type of art has the added element that the person experiencing the art actually participates in it. She describes how this works and the problems of dealing with science and technology. And now, Moira speaks with Dr. Rose.
Dr. Rose, science has always prided itself in objectivity, and the scientific method implores the scientist to separate objective observation of fact from the subjective subsequent analysis and interpretation. Since science as we study it today was primarily created by male scientists, is there in fact a male bias to what we call science in the scientific method?
I think it's both of those things, that it's partly about a bias, but it's partly about a particular understanding of what we mean by objectivity. And just who are we when we say what do we mean by objectivity? Who is in that we? And I think what's been happening as an area of scholarship and politics has been gathered together, which is the feminist study of science, the feminist criticism of science, has been to pull together two sets of things. One group of feminists have gone out, if you like, looking at the bias in science, you know, lousy samples, studies talking about children, which are actually only studies of boys, you name it, it's there. To the other thing, which is trying to look at what has been meant by objectivity. What is the nature of objectivity? Could we construct another definition of objectivity which kept the good things inside what we think of as objectivity and got away with some of the things that many of us don't like about the particular construction of objectivity, which is somehow its unfeelingness?
Tell us how we could change a definition of objectivity.
Well, it's been the construction of objectivity as intensely abstract, intensely impersonal, separated both from the world of people and perhaps the world, curiously, of nature as well. And it's been taking these things apart, and that's both the power of science and also its negativity, in that it's produced a science which, a science and technology, and for me the word science, I should always say, stands in for science and technology. Mm-hmm. Just like, mm-hmm. I can't keep on saying it. but that what it produces is this very violent relationship to the natural world, because it doesn't think about how it works out on the natural world, and that is the claim of objectivity, that is, it is indifferent to the implications.
Oh, that's interesting, because if I sit here and I think about scientific experiments I've participated in or observed or read about, quite often taking the data is very destructive. By destroying to get data, you're not being very friendly to the world about you.
Well, I think that's the construction of science which in the very late 20th century we find ourselves with, and that is a construction of objectivity which is indifferent to, it may or it may not destroy nature. It's not the job of science in this construction of objectivity to think about that. That's left for somebody else. That's left for ethicists. That's left for the Greens. That's left for women. That's left for the others to think about. But the job of science is to think about, or the job of objectivity is to be indifferent and to get on with finding out the knowledge. And I think so partly what feminists have been doing is sort of looking at that and saying, well, but we do want some hard things. I mean, if I, as a woman, am, say, frightened because I have lumps in my breast. I really want to know what will and what won't work. That is, I want objectivity. I want objective knowledge. But I don't want that old construction of objective knowledge, which doesn't take, if you like, me into account. I want a construction of objectivity, which is as reliable, if you like, the double-blind controlled experiment. Yeah? But I don't want it with one whereby I'm left as a thing. I want it whereby all the actors, including the human actors, are taken into account, or the female actors.
My impression of the argument against that is that if you take feeling into account, you're no longer objective.
No, I would have said you'd constructed a new sort of objectivity in which you'd taken feeling into account, and that is supremely, if we're thinking about, rather than the world of green nature, the world of human nature or women's nature, that if you're thinking in the world of biomedicine, the notion that you can look at our bodies as if they were something separate from ourselves, yes, that that's not really practicable, and that you have to actually take feeling into account if you are dealing with something like cancer or pretty much anything else that is around human bodies.
Well, do you think that men and women perceive science differently?
Yes, I do, but I think that's, you know, that's partly part of the picture, but it's also that I think science is actually deeply gendered. It's gendered both in the knowledge that's produced. It's, as it were, predominantly a masculine understanding of the world. And it's also produced in a very simple way, largely by men. I mean, you know, the hot shots, the leading figures within science are predominantly men, and there have been, as in other privileged labour markets, the same sort of mechanisms to make sure that women don't rise too high to the top.
Well, are there gender assumptions which affect how research projects are designed, as well as their conclusions?
Sometimes it's exactly like that. I mean, sometimes, as for example, in much of psychology or in much of sociology of education, I mean, there's a great deal talked about children, and it really has been the study of boy children. I mean, some of the most interesting work ever done in the sociology of education in my own country is proposed as a theory of children. In fact, empirically, they just studied boys and then generalised it out to girls. Now, we, you know, walking around the world, we actually see these young people as slightly different. And if they were the same, why didn't they study girls as well? You know, so there's a kind of a history of very crude bias in exactly the way that you propose it, and that is a sort of complete androcentricity, a complete sort of centering on men, and then proposing that that is science by explaining about the whole of humanity or the whole of children, the whole of men and women, and the research is just plain forwardly biased. I mean, another fun area, if you're a woman, is, for example, nearly all the heart research is done on the bodies of men, okay? So if you go out as a woman and you have a heart problem, you can roughly guess that the cardiologist with whom you are talking is working from a literature based on the physical bodies of men. And then they make various imaginative guesses about what that is for the bodies of women. And it's all about menstruation and different hormones. And if you look at the research, mostly women are cut out. And that's why I'm very much in favour of what's been going on in this country, which is now NIH, the National Institutes of Health. It's have ruled that you can't propose research which is so outrageously biased as to only study the bodies of one sex, when it is relevant and appropriate to study the bodies of both. So, you know, here in Canada, things are better. In my country, we're still on the bodies of men. So it's a sort of, you know, and it's different things in different countries, but it represents how much trouble feminists and their allies have been able to make and how open the scientists have been in various areas to correct the horrendous biases inside the science.
Has that bias continued through to female scientists?
Well, I don't think, I mean, it's very difficult. Supposing as a female scientist you are very conscious of this bias, just what are you to do about it? I mean, there you are on your training program working with a very important male scientist and you say, hey, excuse me, sir, this looks a bit biased. I mean,
not well received. I can tell that right now.
So, I mean, I think there are problems, and it's actually taken not just a single female or several single females. It's taken basically the women's movement to force this readdressing, refocusing of the project of science.
Well, certainly you've pointed out that the subject of investigations having to do with the human body, where they apply to both cases of men and women, that the data must be collected for both men and women. What are other areas of science might be looked at?
Well, another thing that's happened, and that's been going on for pretty much the length of science itself, is the way the scientists construct human nature. And what they do is they say, well, what is a human being? And when you look at what is a human being, you see that to be fully human is to be a man, and that the construction of women in science has substantially been as less than, always less than. And it doesn't really matter particularly which century we're looking at. There's quite an endearing continuity. When you're looking at the construction of women in 16th century science, 17th century science, you sort of almost name the period, and the construction of women is as incomplete, inadequate, somehow lacking, and that a fully fledged human being is equated with the construction of masculinity. And so there's this constant sense, and you see it, for example, you see it in, as I say, ancient books. You know, you think there, that's all gone away. But then if you look at, say, something quite modern like sociobiology, which has been an area of great interest in this country, to a lesser extent in my own, but their women are again constructed, and females generally, they're constructed as inferior.
What is the area of sociobiology?
Well, sociobiology is, for example, looks at the behavior of animals, and then it proposes that it's actually going to make a synthesis between the study of society and the study of animals, and it slips up and down in a quite alarming way between, we'll say, the study of ants, which is E.O. Wilson's area, and, say, the study of people or the behavior of ducks and the study of people. And to me, as a social scientist, I find it a rather strange activity because it seems to me that the world of nature is so extraordinarily diverse. I mean, for example, in some species, the male is very dominant and the female would appear to be fairly subordinate, whereas in other species it's completely the reverse. One of the things that's interesting in this very sort of masculine-centered construction is there seems to be an absolute passion for looking for those areas in nature where, yes, you're right, the female is subordinate and the male is dominant, and a difficulty to notice those bits of nature which might come out without an egalitarian view or another. And it seems to me it's so fundamentally wrong-headed, the notion of looking out there in nature as if your lenses are absolutely neutral, to find the everyday world which we live in with all its complexity. And I see it as an extraordinarily ideologically driven area of science.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Hilary Rose. She is a Bernard Osher Fellow at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, where she's speaking on gender, science, and society. Her most recent book is entitled Love, Power, and Knowledge. Dr. Rose, tell us about love, power, and knowledge.
It runs from Francis Bacon, who is seen as the father of modern science, saying when he proposed the new knowledge of science, natural science, that power is knowledge. And that's an argument it's hard to go away from. To, if you like, a very powerful modern social theorist, Michel Foucault, who speaks of the knowledge-power couple and the connection between knowledge and power, how these two work, is very important in society. And we're an immensely scientific and technological society, and particularly the United States and basically the old industrialized societies. Our lives are dominated by science and technology. But it seems to me that what is left out of that is the thing to do with women, and that is in the division of labor we find ourselves in, women do the nurturing, the loving of children, people, older people, the actual dependence. I don't mean older people who can take care of themselves. I mean elderly people, very sick people, who require nurturance, which I think of as love. So I would say that power and knowledge are likely to produce for us the kind of science and technology which we actually get, which are deeply threatening and could end the human experiment itself. And that is that massive pollution, nuclear disaster, these could, to all intents and purposes, close this particular evolutionary adventure. And that the only thing that checks, or might check, science and technology, which I see on a fairly grim road, are the concerns of nurturance, the concerns of taking care of people. So I see, to the old couple of love, of power and knowledge, we need the thing that is particularly the province of women, which is nurturance, or as I contentedly think of it, as love.
Why should we care about the gender bias in science?
Well, as I was trying to say earlier, I think some things really are very crude, and they really are biased in that very sharp way, which we were speaking of then. But when you speak about the facts of science, I don't think the facts of science are something out there to be read off. I think we construct the facts of science, okay? And that's where subjectivity and objectivity are fused. And there's, if you like, always a choice about how we construct those facts. And those facts could be friendlier towards human beings or less friendly. And I think at the moment they're constructed with indifference. I wish there was a woman at Cambridge here who actually is a feminist physicist who is convinced that her theorising about the physical universe is actually driven by feminist principles and that she will produce a different theory. And she says it's much less abstract. It's much less sort of tidy. It's more muddly. It's more complicated. And she says the men find it very difficult to follow because it's more complex in the way they're talking about. It sounds wonderfully arrogant.
Wouldn't it be nice
that
if it fit in a box?
But it is interesting. I mean, let me tell you about the little things that I see as what I would see as a kind of feminist utopian piece of science, okay? And I'll give it to you an example because it's a good example. It comes out of this city. That is, it's in the history of the search for effective drugs for AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, one of the things is that people who have been invited to take part in experiments have been given the usual deal of some patients get the drug, other people get the placebo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what's happened in this is that the patients have felt that this is a risk they're not willing to take and that they have shared the drugs, the placebo with the effective drugs, on the grounds that everybody should have a chance of life. Now, what's going on in this? You say, well, this is silly. We'll never get the facts out. We'll never find out whether the drug really works or not. But what I think has happened, and it's particularly because it's been AIDS, and that is that AIDS, which has in the West affected men much more sharply than women, there are many men in the business of producing science. So men in this situation have been both sides of the struggle. They've both been the people shut outside, who are the patients with AIDS, and they are men who are in charge of the production of knowledge. And so what's happening is an enormous theoretical attempt to try and work out a new mathematical model which will both test the drugs, but without reducing the patients into kind of just like pieces of furniture. That is, you don't have any say as to whether you're going to have a drug or a placebo. And it ceases to treat people as non-feeling, non-sentient persons. Now, to me, and I find it quite pleasurable to do this, which is to say, look, isn't it interesting? Men experiencing a most terrible epidemic have actually pushed at the nature of the production of scientific knowledge, because it's actually fundamentally unacceptable the double-blind controlled trial. We want the knowledge, which is very powerful from that trial, but we want it in a way that doesn't leave people just like nothing. And so I see that area, and there's some areas in Britain which are very nice about the anxiety about low birth weight babies. It's very much a woman's area in which, as it were, work has been done, which is absolutely wonderful, which shows that you can improve the birth weight of a baby. Nothing could be harder or more factual than that, yes, by making the women happier. And nothing
could be more feelinger
than that. And it's actually recognition that actually having a baby is a complex phenomenon, but it's basically a normal event, yes, and that one of the things that happens when women are having a baby is, let's assume that they're not desperately poor, because it wouldn't matter how much love and support you put into somebody who's desperately poor. You've got to have food, you've got to have shelter, you've got to have housing. Those are bedrock social needs. But having met that bedrock, then if you look after somebody's anxieties and take care of them in a proper, sensible, intelligent way, then actually they have better birth weight babies. Now, I think it's a wonderful example of so-called subjectivity and objectivity coming together. I mean, I want full birth weight babies. They have a better chance of life. And I also want happy women. And I think it's a wonderful piece of feminist research which has managed to bring together subjectivity and objectivity in a beautiful way.
On the other hand, you've opened up that question men have asked forever, and is what do women want? What will make them happy? They can work on that. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Hilary Rose. She is a Bernard Osher Fellow at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, where she's speaking on gender, science, and society. Her new book is entitled Love, Power, and Knowledge. Now, as an engineer, I've personally developed a number of technology systems, and I've been trying to figure out if I bring a female or feminine perspective to the design of those systems and to the implementation of those systems. How does gender bias enter into technology?
I'd put it a different way. I would say, how does gender enter into technology? I mean, it's not a bias. It just is there. You know, so my guess would be that in a society like America at the turn of the century, where the women's movement is enormously powerful and has sort of pervaded women's consciousness in a very subtle way, so you don't have to say, oh, I'm, you know, a totally committed feminist. It's just that, if you like, women walk a little taller, are a little more self-confident, are a bit prouder, are a bit more assertive than they were 25 years ago. So I think those things, women think about themselves and are less embarrassed about not being men. And so once you become not embarrassed about not being a man and you're not denying your own gender formation, then it seems to me it is extremely likely that something is coming in. And what I find fascinating, the number of women engineers, just like you said, women natural scientists, have just said, well, I think I do my science differently because I am a woman. I think I do my engineering differently because I'm a woman. These are, on the whole, I mean, I think it's very brave of you to say that, because on the whole, my knowledge of women scientists and engineers is they say that to one another. They don't say it on public radio.
We don't say it too loud.
But it's really interesting, this, because I think that this conversation between creative women, and it usually is between creative women, is only possible because of this huge social movement which has sort of trickled, touched all our lives. And so we say things that I think our mothers and certainly our grandmothers would have found, even if they were, and perhaps, no, particularly if they were scientists and engineers, would probably have cut their tongues out sooner than say it, because they wanted, and the only way they could survive was to be as neutral as possible. That was as much like the men as possible, and not possibly say, I do my engineering differently, perhaps, because I'm a woman.
Well, I interviewed Dr. Betty Stevenson, who was the first MD to head American Medical Association Society, and it was the Anesthesiology Society.
Yes.
And I was asking her about this, and she is in her 70s now, so she's been a doctor for a good long time. And I said, do you think you bring something different? And her response was actually fairly close to my experience. She said, I had to study the male way of doing things, and unless I could do that, I didn't make the grade. And I didn't resent it. It was just, I didn't think it was the male way of doing things. It was just that there were no females in the room. Yes. They were all male. And it happened to be the way they did it. And the way they interacted, we had to interact. She said, but as a woman, I had many skills that I didn't think to bring to my profession until later on. And so rather than saying, I do it differently per se, I do it like a woman, she said, I have the advantage of having other experiences that men, frankly, often don't have because of their male societal, you know, experience. And so I could bring both things together and actually have a more complete experience by just that opportunity.
Well, I think women are one of the several peculiar groups in society. And what I mean by that is, and the story of Betty Stevenson does it beautifully for me, that is that women are both inside the culture and outside the culture. And you have to be able to operate within the culture, or you don't become a doctor, you don't become an engineer. But at the same time, you're not entirely comfortable there, so you're conscious of having other skills. And so there's this sense in which women who are conscious of themselves as gendered beings and are not just trying to, you know, sort of wipe their brains clear and just live in a state of denial, but to actually, so there's a kind of almost pleasurable trafficking across between knowing that, well, that's the way they, the men, do it, and that's the way that women do it. Now, I'm conscious that, as it were, we're two white women sitting here having this conversation, but I'm extremely sure that conversation could be replicated if, say, a Native American person was sitting here having that conversation, that they would also talk about a Native American philosophy. And as it were, both being inside the culture, if they were, say, a doctor, Western doctor, but also outside the culture because of having access to another culture, another set of values. And so there's this kind of trafficking. And when I'm feeling optimistic, I think, gosh, this is, you know, it's good, the lot of the things about present society, and that is, I mean, there's a zillion things wrong. You know, I can't bear seeing all the homeless people in the streets, you know, here or in my city. But it's, there's also this wonderful thing, as it were, the culture trying to change itself and become more complicated, more plural, and even the scientific culture becoming a little more complicated and plural. And that's going on at the same time that at another level I feel it's becoming so monolithic that I feel quite desperate.
I can imagine all of these male listeners out there scratching their heads, if they're still with us here, saying, well, what am I supposed to do? I've got along here and I've made quite a career out of being an engineer or a scientist or a technologist, or I'm a lawyer or whatever I'm doing. And I can see them scratching their heads and saying, well, yeah, I'm just doing my job. I'm just, what am I supposed to think? What am I supposed to do?
Well, the strange thing about, you know, the women's movement and the demands it's been making are partly that I think women and men, and you're inviting me to reflect on men, we find ourselves a bit uncomfortable. And I suppose I'm saying that it's an old utopian project, that a more comfortable society, one that lives less violently with nature, one that lives less violently women and men together, where there's less murder, there's less sexual harassment, where it's a gentler society, that can only come when men bring women into that society. And I think it's both the women pushing at the doors and the men opening them. And that's quite an amusing metaphor to use when you think of how, you know, feminists say, well, we don't want the men to open the doors. But I think when it comes into the doors, into jobs, you know, making it easier for women to get in, making the jobs friendlier for them, being more considerate towards them, making it possible to change the institutions so they're not organized around a man's world, then I think men can do a great deal. And it is the laboratories, it is, I don't know, the radio stations where men have been a bit more welcoming, that women have found it possible to get in. We do need some nice men, I'm saying. It's difficult for us to talk about. There's a lot of really sort of tremendously, I mean, you know, there are some men who are absolutely determined at all costs to keep women out, no matter how miserable they make their own lives and everybody else's around them. And there are some who are just great, great patriarchs. There's a lot of men who I think want to live in different ways. They want to have different relationships with their children, with the women who are important in their lives. And those men, I think, can do very interesting, important things for us.
Moira's guest has been Dr. Hilary Rose. She's a Bernard Osher Fellow at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. Her most recent book is entitled Love, Power, and Knowledge. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with Dr. Moira Gunn. Beverly Reiser is president of ILUM, an international society of artists using science and technology. She's a high-tech artist herself, most recently working with interactive electronic environments.
As a scientist and an engineer, I'm fully entitled to say, I don't know if that's art, but it sure looks like science and technology. When does science and technology become art?
My definition for art is that it has to have some kind of an insight into what it means to be human. And if it says something about what it means to be human, then it's art.
Looking at pieces of, you know, science and technology, my tendency is to look at the
technology.
Let's figure out how this means, what this is doing. How do I build one of these kind of things? I am really not too familiar with looking at some technology and realizing that it's there to have an emotional impact on me or any kind of an impact on me. How does that occur?
When you first see them, you can't resist that urge to figure out how did they do it. But after a while, then the buzz wears off. In fact, after about 30 seconds, the buzz wears off. And then, or as you're walking down the street afterwards, you think, but what did it say? Did it say anything that I can take home with me other than a new trick? So after a little while, you begin to ask, did it have any content, or was it just the fastest and the brightest and the biggest that we've seen this week? So that would be my criterion.
Well, in technical circles, anything that is not the latest, greatest, hottest, whatever technology is often poo-pooed. You know, you have to have the latest, as in, well, that's not hot anymore. Do artists have this same tendency to want to work with only the hottest technology available?
Well, there is an urge to, you know, try the new. You see a new thing and you want to incorporate it in some way, especially if you think you can augment something that you've been trying to say, but you didn't quite have the means or the memory or the speed or whatever it took to do it. But ultimately, it does have to say something beyond that.
You've exhibited your award-winning video piece, Life on a Slice, to groups of artists as well as to groups of technical types at SIGGRAPH, which is the Association for Computing Machinery's Special Interest Groups in Computer Graphics. First of all, tell us about Life on a Slice, and then tell us how differently, if differently at all, artists and the general public and techies react to your work.
Well, this goes back a little to the question you just asked about the technical side of it. The first SIGGRAPH conference that we did with Life on the Slice, which is an interactive computer video installation about the size of a small room. As we were driving through the desert to Las Vegas, which was where it was that year, see, we had all of our computers and stuff piled in the car, and it occurred to me, oh my God, everybody else there is going to have silicon irises, and what am I going to do? We're just going to look terrible. We're going to look like the flea market. But the curious thing was that everybody else did have silicon irises, and it didn't make any difference. People came into our installation, and often it actually worked to our advantage in that people would come in and say, oh, we like this so much better because it's more human, it's more sort of handcrafted, and the others are so hard and cerebral, and we can identify with this, it's more eccentric. so after that, I decided to never be intimidated by the high end. And then actually, by now, I've come to think in low res. I've been doing it so long. So if you have something to say, you can say it no matter what. Because after all, you know, if you look at Picasso, he used pen and ink, and, you know, he did have something to say. So it wasn't a problem to him. Although when I first started doing Life on a Slice, I was worried about being on the ragtag bleeding edge of the thing, but it worked out just fine.
Tell us exactly what Life on a Slice does.
It's an interactive installation. The person is basically a one-person theater. One-person and computer theater. You walk into a spot, and the video camera catches your image live. And then it takes your video image and combines it with the images in the computer, the images and the narrative, or various narratives in the computer.
So you become part of the screen that you're observing.
Right. On the wall in front of you, life size, you see your image, and you see the graphics in the computer. And in Life on a Slice, for instance, we had one called Temple of the Goddesses, and it was a visit to a holy shrine, a virtual holy place. And you would go in and see your image in a computer graphics shrine, you know, with arches and the whole thing. And then you'd see these sort of undulating hips on one side that are those famous hips from the truncated Venus. And then on the other side,
you're pretty wild, Beverly.
On the other side, you see these sort of smoochy lips. And if you reached out and touched one of them, it would take you to whatever that the lips or the hips referred to. So then in one case, you'd go to this part of an episode with a Venus icon. And you'd get to sort of play with fire and at first not be burned, but eventually the Venus icon in your image would catch fire. And then you would explode, and about that time Nemesis would show up. So, and then it goes on from there. Eventually you get a choice between the Cerebral Cathedral and the Feral Forest.
It sounds like an adventure game, but you're in it.
Yeah, and it's not a game in that there's a win or lose or shoot 'em up or anything like that, and there's no score. There's four different endings to it because the plot branches twice. So you get to different endings depending on choices you made upstream. So the endings are all different. Hopefully at the end there's an insight or a reflection on the choices that you made.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Beverly Reiser. She's an artist working with interactive environments, and she is president of ILEM, an international organization of artists using science and technology. Beverly, tell us about ILEM.
Well, it's a group of about 260 people. Most of them are in California, but we do have a scattering of people all over the globe. Of course, that's not surprising with all of today's electronic messaging services and email and satellites and so forth. We have a newsletter, which is a monthly. And it has things like, it has a calendar telling about our events plus other events, the shows that our artists are in, conferences that our artists might be interested in. ILEM is going to do an evening at the Anand Salon in San Francisco. The Anand Salon's kind of it's a salon, I guess, a kind of like the traditional salons that there used to be in Paris, except that the art, of course, is quite different. And it's an apartment that's made into little environments. And so, you know, every half hour or something, a new little event will suddenly arise in some corner or other.
I have to say that the artists that I know, and some of them are my best friends, honest, they always say, I hate technology. I hate having to deal with computers. I hate having to do this kind of thing. And yet, here are artists who are working with technology. Is that a frustration for many of them?
Well, I think the things that are the most engaging things in life are often both horrible and wonderful, and you love and hate them at the same time. And there are times when I absolutely hate computers, especially when it's the night before I have to leave for a trip a long ways away and suddenly the computer scrambles its brains. But on the other hand, when it works, it's like magic. You know, I mean, it really is magical when it works, when all those little phosphors start glowing and your image is there.
Paint is technology and canvas is technology. When we talk about artists using science and technology, what are we talking about? What kinds of different technologies are we talking about?
I think artists of any era use whatever washes up on their mud bank. And these days, sensors and processors and monitors are washing up on our mud banks. I think it's a pretty healthy thing that we try to use what's there, sort of the flotsam and jetsam of our time, and make something, transform it into hopefully something insightful, something that says something about what it means to be human, some kind of insight into human consciousness and the experience of living.
You've been working in interactive environments. What other kinds of pieces would there be?
We have one member, Ken Rinaldo, who makes, well, these are our interactive, but they're a little bit different.
Yeah.
They're appendages. They're like limbs, almost like an arm, except that the arm is made out of microprocessors and grapevines. So it has a little bit of an organic quality because it's not totally metal, and grapevines are very irregular. But it is an appendage with processors. And so you would walk into a room where there were, and the appendages are 6 feet long. They're sort of like those long desk lamps. They hang from the ceiling. So here are these long appendages, and they sense it when you enter the room, and they sense where you are, and they sense where the other arms are, and then they respond to each other, and then they respond to you, depending on what he's programmed into them to do. They might come towards you, and then they might have a conversation with their other appendages, and then they might, decide you're not worth dealing with and go away and do something.
I was getting goosebumps when you were talking about that.
I think they're friendly appendages. I haven't seen them do anything intrusive. But his work comes out of an interest in living systems, and you'll find that a lot of this work is modeled on things we've recently discovered about the human brain. And one of the things that Ken uses is that our brain is composed of a lot of little cells, many of which are not highly intelligent, but they all have a little intelligence. And it's really when they assemble as a whole that they develop a large intelligence. And so his appendages are an attempt to model that in a exterior form, because, of course, it's not too easy to look at your brain.
Now give some other examples.
Another one, two people, a husband and wife team, who call themselves Synapse. That's Will Clogley and Sandra Slade. And they do immersive environments, which, they'll have from 10 to maybe 30 slide projectors. And the projectors have thousands of slides in them, but they'll be programmed by a computer so that one slide blends into another quite rapidly and in some very interesting ways. And then they'll also have lasers that give it a little zip projected on the slide projections. But they're more than slide projections. They do whole environments in which the environment is largely projected. And then within this environment, there might also be other artists doing little sort of cameo performances, a little musical performance. But basically, everybody's interested in some form of VR. I almost hate to use the word because it gets stretched so far. But
virtual reality.
Right. Mm-hmm. In any case, there's a lot of interest in art that surrounds you and interacts with you in some way and that responds to you. And some of the architects are getting interested in intelligent buildings, and then also artists are doing installations like mine, for instance. Dancers are attaching sensors of various sorts to their bodies so they can use their bodies as instruments. So if they move in a certain way, it sends a MIDI signal, and that creates a certain kind of sound. I think the most significant thing, the environments are not passive. They're not like going to a movie where you see this grand, engrossing world that's separate from you that somebody else made. Now, it is an environment that somebody else made, but it is made to respond to your presence and your idiosyncratic behavior. And sometimes with you knowing it, and other times without you knowing it. But it also gives you choices. I think choice is important because that's a completely different view of art, that the viewer would have a choice and that the art becomes discursive.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Beverly Reiser. She's an artist working with interactive environments, and she is president of ILEM, an international organization of artists using science and technology. Beverly, you alluded to this earlier about curators suddenly becoming interested in what's going on out there. Are there artists or museums or galleries or who reject or at least suspicious of this intentional use of science and technology?
Most curators are already committed. It's not that they necessarily have anything against technology. They're already committed to their backgrounds and their knowledge base that they already have in paintings and sculpture. And for the most part, they haven't gone to great lengths to ferret out electronic art, with a few exceptions. But actually, I think that this has been quite wonderful because it's allowed or maybe forced electronic artists to create their own venues. We've developed these, I think, wonderful venues that are no longer dependent on the whims of the art world, which really does cater to a very small percentage of the population. For instance, there's SIGGRAPH, which is a big global conference that attracts 20,000 to 60,000 people. And on my way back from one of them, I was counting, and I figured out that a week at SIGGRAPH was equal to 5 to 10 years of shows and galleries. So when you look at it that way, we're really not doing badly.
Since technology is always changing, does the obsolescence of the technology in a piece of artwork, is that part of your art?
Like everything these days, it mutates. So life on a slice is currently mutating onto a different computer system than the one it was on before, because we want to, like everybody else, we want to do a CD. But we want it to be a CD of interactive art. So it won't be like Treasures of the Smithsonian, where you ask for a certain painter and then it comes up with a picture of work by that painter. It'll be a piece in which you'll start the piece, and just like the pieces that I described in the installations, you'll move along in the piece. In a way, like the games that are on CDs, except that it won't be a game.
we just
mutate onto new systems and maybe get a little bit higher resolution, maybe get a little faster, maybe get a little bit longer.
What new technologies excite you?
Well, CDs, for the reasons I just said. Of course, the CDs, well, they're multimedia. They have sound. They have visuals. They could trigger all kinds of things, depending on how you set them up. I think CDs are the most exciting possibility, because actually a CD is a venue. That's a venue that doesn't even require a place. Well, eventually it would require a place, but it could replace the gallery system, for instance. You could have mail-order CDs instead of galleries.
So you go in and experience your art. You get your CD and you would experience it.
Yeah, and hopefully it'll either be available for a number of systems or by then, well, at least enough people out there will have a system that your particular CD will play on. The platform is the big issue these days, because nobody is sure at this point what platform, or maybe there'll be a group of platforms that coexist.
Well, I think from the technology side, certainly technology always moves along, and every time you create something, if it's just a computer system, as in my case, which I usually create those types of things, I always create it thinking it'll be around forever, and it took me a long time before I realized that it was only going to be around a few years. You were lucky if 5 or 6 years it was still there operating in the same way. And because of the obsolescence or the evolution of technology, the platforms that it ran on before sort of gently and sometimes very rapidly go out of existence. And so to preserve the artwork that you have now, you would have to be able to mutate them or evolve them through a number of systems. We think of old records and things like that. Can we still play them? And it does require a set of technology to do that, so that changes things.
Well, I notice there is a new verb these days, and it's versioning.
Ooh, in the art world.
They'll either have to version or mutate.
That's great. You work with your son.
Yes.
How does that work?
Actually, strangely enough, it works very well. From time to time, people will say to Hans, my son, oh, you're following in your mother's footsteps. But I think it's really the other way around. I think maybe I'm following in his footsteps, because he's that generation in their 20s of hackers who spent their childhood hanging out in the computer system at UC. Also, I find he has a different take on things than I do. So what usually happens is I generate some images, because I'm very image-oriented, and I have a kind of an idea of a sort of a narrative, I guess. And I put it all together, and then Hans comes along. Hans is a programmer and has, I have to say, a gift for clarity. I have more of a gift for digression. But anyway, Hans comes along with his metaphorical butcher knife and throws out at least half of the pictures and leaves me bleeding there. My electrons are bleeding, I guess. But usually he's right, I have to admit.
So does he get the images into the computer then?
No, I'm sort of the image maker. He and I work together on the idea and the storyboard and the direction. He's very structurally oriented, and he has this kind of lean and mean aesthetic. So occasionally we get into an arm wrestle over what can stay, and occasionally I dig my feet into the ground. In the end, it turns out pretty well, I think. He's usually right.
When you're creating an image, are you taking a picture of something and scanning it into the computer, or how are you doing that?
Sometimes I'll see an image. Well, like with Temple of the Goddesses, I went back through all of my picture books, all the beautiful images I had collected in the 60s when I was very interested in Carl Jung and the metaphorical significance of traditional images. And for Temple of the Goddesses, I collected images of ancient goddesses. But by the time they got into the computer, they were fairly altered, although they did, I think, maintain some of the quality of the archaic images. But they don't look like an image that was taken from a book, because they had to be reworked to work in this low-res
the low-resolution screen.
Right.
But how did you get them from the book into the computer?
Sometimes I just draw them. Mm. I had a lot of background in drawing and painting and printmaking, and I seem
to... So you draw them with your mouse?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, with a mouse. And we're now that we're mutating into a new system that's a PC system, we've ordered a digitizing tablet, which will be closer to a traditional drawing with pen and ink, because you'll have a stylus and you draw on a pad. So it's a little bit more like the drawing that I was brought up to do. But it is amazing. I mean, our brains are quite fantastic at making adjustments between one tool and another. Even though the mouse looks terribly awkward in the way it is, you can very quickly get so that you look at the screen and your arm moves with the mouse, and it's very much like drawing. I mean, somehow we just have that ability to transfer. I don't know, maybe we reassemble our whatever it is to suit new tools very readily, I think. And so working with computers, it makes you more and more aware of what a leap the human mind is, what a fantastic thing it is in the whole universe, what a miraculous moment human consciousness is.
How has the venue of science and technology changed your art? Obviously, when you were doing art 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there wasn't a lot of science and technology around.
That's true. Well, I would say about 20 years ago, we started seeing new images. Sometimes they were from electron microscopes. They would magnify molecules and atoms so large that we could see the nucleus of an atom. And we saw that microstructure. I think that was very important. I think we began to think of ourselves as a system of systems. And if there's one thing that working with a computer teaches you, it's that the human brain is really fantastic. In the end, instead of being totally in awe of a computer, you really do end up being totally in awe of human consciousness, because it's so complex and it has so many nested structures within structures within structures, with an ability to process that's just fantastic. Like Data on Star Trek, you know how Data is always trying to understand human humor, and he can't do it. He can't tell a joke, so it's funny. He can only be funny by accident. Well, machines still don't understand humor. Working with computers, it makes you more and more aware of what a leap the human mind is, what a fantastic thing it is in the whole universe, what a miraculous moment human consciousness is.
Moira's guest has been Beverly Reiser, president of ILAM, an international society of artists using science and technology. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. 855-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.